Welcome to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. The Iowa legislature this week is deciding which measures will make it to the House and Senate floor. There have been several contentious bills, but the so-called Educational Choice Bill brought out dozens of supporters and opponents at a committee meeting yesterday. Under the school choice bill, the state would take most of the money that would normally cover one student's education in a public school and give it to a family to cover private school tuition instead. The bill's author estimates that about $50 million would be diverted from public to private schools each year. Cedar Falls Republican Representative Walt Rogers is the House Education Committee chairman. Rogers says the bill is an effort to give parents of all income levels a chance to send their children to the best school possible.
Essentially, we create educational savings accounts for parents that would basically then direct those dollars. We're taking a portion of the state cost per pupil. Presently, our state cost per pupil is $6,664 per pupil in the state. That's just state dollars. There's also federal dollars and some other little dollars. And sometimes that brings that number all the way up to 11 grand. But we're just dealing with the 6,664. Of that amount, just the state portion, which would be the non-property tax portion, is about 5 grand. So we're going to take 90% of that 5 grand and direct it to what's called an educational savings account. The parents could then use those dollars for tuition to an accredited non-public school.
Why do you think it's so important to have this bill?
Because I believe parents should be able to direct their tax dollars to educate their own kids. I think they should have the right to be able to direct those tax dollars. And so, and it gives more opportunity. I get emails, I get people talking to me about, the opportunities for their kids are in their own zip code, in their own district are limited. And not to say that public schools are doing a great job across the state. We've got one of the best states in the country for taking care of our public school kids, but a public school doesn't meet everybody's needs. And so I just think it's a bill that says, let's give more opportunity to kids, let's give more options to parents, so that we can educate in all facets of education in our state and, again, give more opportunities to kids.
Would this include any kind of charter school?
Yes. In fact, we are opening up our charter school opportunities. Presently, we have a limited amount of availability for charter schools in the state, and so this bill also does that. Basically makes it more applicable and more of an opportunity for school districts to start specific charter schools and for organizations from outside of the state to come in and help begin a charter school for whatever specific reason that they deem necessary, making sure that they follow our charter school laws. But, I think we only have one or two actual charter schools in the state right now. And again, to me, this is just more opportunity for specific needs across the state for specific students.
Why has it been so slow, the charter school movement here in Iowa?
I'm not really sure, other than, I do think we do have good public schools. And some people just haven't really realized the opportunities that could be out there. And so there's just been more of a push in the past couple of years for us to kind of loosen our charter school guidelines to give, again, going back to opportunity for kids. And so that's the reason we're doing it.
You've got a lot of pushback from some Democrats in the House who are concerned about the low level of funding. They say this year increase for the state's public schools. They're concerned that this takes money away from them. What do you think? Do you think that they could have a point?
what we're doing with this bill is taking a percentage of the state portion where school choice is an option around the country. We've seen approximately about a 2% amount of people utilize it. So, you know, that's a, in the scheme of the whole state, I still think that's a fairly low number and will not dramatically change where public schools are funded. And so because we just take the state portion, the school districts continue to get the uniform levy. So they're getting property tax dollars for students that aren't, that won't be there. They'll still get some of the federal dollars. They'll still get some of the dollars that is generated by SAVE, which is the infrastructure, school infrastructure, 1 cent penny tax. So in that sense, they'll still get a lot of those same dollars for students that aren't even in their buildings. And so I think it's, you know, there's a lot of pushback, like you said, yes, that we're going to, you know, I can see things on social media and like it's going to ruin rural schools or public education. You know, that low percentage, I don't think that's going to happen. In fact, I'm sure it's not going to happen. And in the long run, what it does is open up opportunities and open up areas where people see, hey, this is happening, this is a good thing. And in fact, some of the research has shown where it's tried, the public schools actually become better. And so I look forward to, you know, continue talking about it, continue to look at all the options and see what Iowans think about it.
New kindergarten students would have access to these as well as any student currently attending a public school who switches to a private school, but those currently attending non-public schools would not.
Yeah, we just, because that would be a direct transfer of dollars from a lot of those students. And so I felt like that was basically the bill that was introduced last year. And meaning if all the private school students, which are about 33,000, 34,000, somewhere there, all of a sudden got educational savings accounts, that would be hard for the budget to sustain, especially in some of these tight years. So with this bill, it's incremental. It's something that with just these students that are already in it, our dollars are already appropriated, and so those dollars would just simply follow them to a non-public, and we would not have to appropriate anything more. The reason we're going 90% is to help fund some of those kindergartners that would be going in.
You know, it does seem like this has made your bill for some people more likely to be acceptable than the bill last year. You think you have a pretty good chance of success this year?
Well, there seems to be a lot more discussion about it, so that's good. The next step, obviously, is to pass this up to me, which is scheduled tomorrow morning, and then I will present it to my full committee. And if we can get it past my full committee, then, you know, it's something that could be discussed on the floor. So I would love to at least be discussing it as a whole in my chamber and get people thinking about it in the state because, you know, like you said, we're going to get a lot of pushback from the teacher union, but I believe we're all wanting the same thing. We want to educate kids in the state of Iowa as best as possible can. And I believe this is something that will do that.
That was Cedar Falls Republican Representative Walt Rogers, the House Education Committee chair. He was talking about the school choice bill that will likely go before the full House and Senate for debate sometime soon. Republicans and Democrats have been split down party lines on the school choice bill and several other bills that are facing committee deadlines this week. Sioux City Democratic Representative Chris Hall also opposes the measure. Hall also has concerns about the viability of other Republican-sponsored measures. I talked with him earlier this week about those measures and what he thinks of the school choice bill.
It's an issue that has developed over several years. I think that obviously there's broad interest both in public education as well as private education in the state, and trying to find the right point of understanding what can and should be funded by public taxpayer dollars is really what the debate hinges on. Most folks that I've spoken to, of course, think that rules and transparency have to follow public money. With public schools being funded by Iowa taxpayers, taxpayers should also have the right to expect rules, transparency, and some of the reports that go along with tax dollars.
Do you think that this bill is going to be successful?
The bill has some strong interest within the Republican majority party, and I think there are other legislators who are certainly willing to consider funding for educational savings accounts. The biggest question right now is whether the state can actually afford it. We have underfunded public schools already. Seven of the last 8 years have been the lowest funding that public schools have ever received. And a budget principle that I certainly try to follow and encourage my colleagues to consider is whether we should be creating new programs at the same time that we can't fully fund programs that already exist. The price tag of creating a program like this in the past has been estimated to cost several hundreds of millions of dollars. And whether the state can actually afford it right now at this moment in time, when we're seeing budget mismanagement and really an ongoing crisis within our public funding, we need to at least push the brakes and ask ourselves some hard questions first.
This religious freedom bill, businesses feel like they should have a right, some of them, to say no, to not serve people that maybe they don't agree with their beliefs or how they live their lives. But other people say that having this kind of bill and allowing that to happen would actually drive business away from Iowa.
I have spoken to the CEO of one of the largest employers here in the state of Iowa, and they are vehemently opposed to this religious freedom bill and bills that have passed in other states. When you look at it, it is really just a backdoor way to legalize discrimination. It does not truly allow for any greater business practice than to choose who you discriminate against. And so some of the larger employers are opposed to it, mainly because they don't want discrimination to be written into state code. And they see it as something that will make it harder to attract their workforce and to attract younger workers in particular to this state. Iowa has a stagnant population. We're not growing at a very fast pace compared to other states. And some of the biggest employers and businesses in this state say that this bill is going to make it harder for us to do that in the future.
Another bill that was hotly debated, discussed in this particular week, Funnel Week, was the fetal heartbeat bill. And a lot of people who spoke up about the bill said that they were worried it would make it not only hard for women to get access to abortion, but also make it hard for healthcare providers.
The bill is not one that I have read yet. I believe it's originating over in the Senate Judiciary Committee, and so I haven't had time to page through it. But my understanding is that even many groups such as the Catholic Diocese, who are very interested in the debate over access to reproductive health and life, they're registered neutral on the bill because they know it is unconstitutional. We shouldn't be creating legislation with the knowledge that it's unconstitutional, that it denies women access to reproductive health care that they are constitutionally obliged to have. And so it's, I think, a misstep on behalf of the legislature to bring these bills up, knowing that they just create constitutional questions, that they're going to get bogged down in legal fights, and that most interpretations of the law dating back several decades deem this to be an unconstitutional debate.
So this is, as we were saying, Funnel Week. How is it different this year than last year? Because last year it seemed like there were a couple of really big issues, and this year there seemed to be several more issues going on.
This is my eighth legislative session, and what has been true last year and this year is that government doesn't function quite as well when one party has control. That's true of whichever party that happens to be in control, but you know, the Republican majority doesn't seem to be able to get the trains to run on time. We're in our sixth week of debate. We still haven't considered some major legislation that most people anticipated at the beginning of this session. The Speaker and the Majority Leader in the Senate don't seem to even be able to work out some of their basic disagreements. And so far, it feels like the legislature has not done much, and the things that it is bringing up and moving forward are controversial. They're not things that reflect most polling or most general values of the state population. So I think it's a very partisan atmosphere to work in. It's not one that has incorporated minority views or one that reflects most of the people I represent. Mm. The one issue that I expect to continue in the next week or so is just budget discussions. The state really has been mismanaged over the last 2 years, and a big part of that is now we are paying back $144 million of debt borrowed by the governor last year, and it's hampered our efforts to invest in other places like public education. If we have to make budget cuts in the next week or two at a time where our economy is growing, that is historically unheard of. It's not something that the state has had to do outside of real economic recessions or natural disasters. And I think that voters should be a little bit more cautious about the way the state is using their dollars right now.
That was Sioux City Democratic Representative Chris Hall. The final deadline for bills in the Iowa legislature that will make it to the House and Senate floor for debate is this Friday. Listening to The Exchange on Siouxland Public Media. I'm Mary Hartnett. Today we often say technology has transformed communication, but that's not a modern phenomenon. From the printing press to iPads, advances in printing technology have played a huge part in changing how we connect and the path of history. Harvard University English professor and author Martin Puchner writes about this and the role of literature around the world in his book, The Written Word, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, and Civilization. The book leads readers on a journey through time and around the world to reveal the powerful role stories and literature have played in creating the world we have today. Puchner says he's wanted to write this book for a very long time.
I think I wanted to write it because of an experience we all share, namely that new technologies are fundamentally changing how we communicate with written words. And that's making a lot of difference in the media, but also in the kind of stories we tell. So, and, you know, I'm as disoriented by that as anyone, I think. So I wanted to look back at the prehistory of that and look at what had happened at earlier moments when new technologies changed the written world, technologies like the alphabet or paper or papyrus or parchment or print, and to get some guidance from this deep 4,000-year long history of writing and technology.
You talk a lot about early texts, and you talk about Gutenberg and the printing press. What was it about this particular person that made this happen?
Yeah, the story of Gutenberg is fascinating. It's sometimes presented like he had this one idea, this one big idea, and then inventing the printing press with movable type. But that's actually not true. There was print hundreds of years before Gutenberg in East Asia, and Gutenberg knew something about that process. So it wasn't this one breakthrough idea. It's more like he recognized what could be done with these relatively primitive forms of print that had made it into Northern Europe. And he basically created the first industrial division of labor and production process for the production of books, and he made a lot of small inventions along the way. For example, East Asian printing hadn't used a press, but he realized that if you pressed the type hard into the paper, you could get better results. So he used something that was ubiquitous in the wine country around Mainz, where he lived, namely a wine press. So he was the first to use a wine press for the printing process. he also used a way of mass producing different type. So that really facilitated the mass production of books. So he made a lot of little inventions along the way, and he had a kind of entrepreneurial spirit. He set up a private and secret company for the production of books because he recognized that it could be hugely profitable. So I think of him more like someone like Steve Jobs than the one inventor with this one big idea.
It's interesting too how with Gutenberg and then with Benjamin Franklin, well, centuries later, it seems like to be successful, a technology or a new kind of printing or a new kind of book or pamphlet, there needs to be some kind of movement. And the Reformation seemed to be something that was going on in the years after Gutenberg and Ben Franklin. Revolution was going on here. Do these things often coincide, like big events taking advantage of this technology?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Mary. And I would say it's more than a coincidence. I think these new technologies or the new uses of writing technologies actually played a large role in bringing about these events. So the Reformation was really an effect of the printing press, because Martin Luther was this obscure Bible professor, but he started to use the printing press in order to get the word to use in his struggle against the established church. And it turned out that the church had completely underestimated the force of print, that it would allow someone without much institutional standing to become a kind of celebrity. And Martin Luther dominated the world of print for several decades in a way that was unprecedented. And I would say something similar about the American Revolution. Ben Franklin assembled essentially the first media network in the 13 North American colonies. He controlled everything from paper makers, the paper supply, to the printing presses. Of course, he was a printer by profession, to the newspapers, and even the postal roads on which newspapers were transported. So through this media empire, Franklin helped lay the groundwork for the American Revolution. So I think these big upheavals, historical upheavals, didn't just coincide with these new technologies. They were partially caused by them.
You say world literature is very important. I mean, here often in the United States, people tend to read a lot of American literature, British literature, although that seems to be changing.
It is, and I think that's a good thing. You know, one of the interesting things that happens when you look at the big picture, as I try to do in the book, looking at 4,000 years of literature and the important texts that have shaped our world, you know, many of them obviously come from the ancient world before there was even this distinction between the West and the rest. You realize that there are all these important texts from around the world that have contributed to the world we live in. So I think it's really crucial that people read outside their somewhat narrow national literary traditions, and that they read world literature, not just literature from around the world, but also literature from the deep history of writing, all 4,000 years of it. And this is what I try to sort of entice people to do by making that as interesting and fascinating as I possibly can.
I notice in high schools, if anyone has spent any time in a high school lately, they'll notice that the literature books often have translations of works from many different cultures and countries.
I'm the general editor of the Norton Anthology of World Literature that's used in a lot of college classrooms, but also in high schools. And I've visited many of the schools, or some of the schools that adopt the anthology. And it's been a very moving experience. Many of our adopters are in the South, for example. Many are in very rural or remote places, teaching world literature to students who haven't had an opportunity to travel much, maybe don't even have a passport. So it's a way for these teachers to bring the world to their students and give the students a sense of other parts of the world in a deep way, because if you read this literature, even in translation, you to these foundational texts of different cultures, you have access to some almost like a DNA of different cultures by reading these foundational texts. And I think that can be a very moving experience for students.
Do you think that technology, being able to get a book almost instantly in, you know, so many different languages and translations online, do you think that has really changed the way we look at the whole process of reading and literature?
I think it does, and it's one of the great things about our internet revolution, that so much of world literature is really available at our fingertips. It's something that actually happened at earlier moments of transformation as well. It's often the case that the most canonical texts are the early adopters of new technologies. You know, we talked a moment ago about Gutenberg. The first book that he printed was the Latin Bible. And earlier I talked about Chinese print, and the earliest existing printed work in the world is a Buddhist sutra, another sacred canonical text. So I think the same thing is happening today, that a lot of canonical world literature is now available the way it never was before. And that's going to be a good thing.
You talk about the importance of preserving endangered languages and literatures. It said it's based on your family's connection to a forgotten thieves. Is it an argot?
You notice that, Mary? Yeah, that's the book I'm currently writing. It's about a secret language, a language of the underground, spoken in Europe for many hundreds of years, from the Middle Ages to the 20th century. And my family has a weird connection to it. My uncle was obsessed with this language. He actually translated bits of world literature into this thieves argot to make it legitimate. And my grandfather was also obsessed with it. So it's a kind of strange family inheritance, which meant that I kind of grew up with this thieves language that almost no one knew about. I sort of took this for granted and considered this pretty normal when I was growing up, but it took me a while to realize that maybe it was a little bit unusual. So I'm now trying to write about that forgotten underground world through this forgotten language.
What was that world like?
Well, it was basically a world that took place on the road. It was spoken by peddlers and vagrants and thieves and journeymen, anyone who did not lead a settled life, anyone who was forced onto the road, sometimes by choice, sometimes by necessity. It's a language that was thriving during times of wars and upheaval, because there would be more migrants and they would start to speak this language of the road. They would be kind of inducted into this secret language. It was sort of a language of a milieu of this underground world, and people who drifted into it or were born into it used it as their language to speak amongst themselves, but also to keep what they were saying secret from others.
You know, it almost seems like you'd have to have two lifetimes to achieve and write about all the things you'd like to write about. Do you ever feel that way?
I certainly feel that. But, you know, I have lots of interests and enthusiasms, I find the best way to satisfy that is to write about it and try to convey that enthusiasm to others. And that's true of this big book on world literature, The Written World. And I think it's also true of this very different book about the secret language, which is a much more obscure topic. But I tried to write about it in a way that I think may be applicable to people's lives, because we all use language. We always use words both to communicate something, but also to hide things. So I think of it as a book about language, really, and how we use it.
That was Martin Puchner. He is a professor of English at Harvard University and the author of the book, The Written World, The Power of Stories to Shape People, History, and Civilization. He's also the author of several volumes on world literature, including the Norton Anthology of World Literature.